We're delighted to welcome with us this morning Central Wisconsin Christian. Would the students please stand? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. The students are here with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. It's a national award-winning program in which high school students across the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the students get the briefs for the case they're about to hear and may engage in outside activities relating to this case. And also as part of the program, a justice meets with the student after the second oral argument. Everyone is invited at that meeting, and the discussion is on the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved in the particular case. So let me introduce the students, justices to you. We may have students entering late, and they will be from Richland Center High School, but they haven't yet arrived, so I wanted counsel to be prepared if they hear rustling that it is other students arriving. Let me introduce the court to you. On my far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. She is the justice with whom the students will meet at noon today. Seated next to her is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I'll call the first case, but I'll also ask if anyone in the audience wants a summary of the case we are about to hear, just raise your hand and the marshal will deliver it to you. All right, the first case is 06AP1954CR, State versus Keith A. Davis. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Davis is Chris Gramstrom. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning. My name is Chris Gramstrom. I'm in solo practice up in Superior. I represent Keith Davis. I won't recite the facts, only as they might apply as they arise in my argument. And for the sake of our argument, I would indicate that I use the terms voice stress analysis and polygraph examination interchangeably, although the technology is obviously different on those two devices. I think that the legal theories as they apply to the case law are the same in either instance.
Well, just let me see if I can clarify one fact. There was a confession here.
Yes.
At what point was the confession made? Was it before the voice stress, or we can call it polygraph, during the polygraph, or after the polygraph?
This is, I categorize VSA cases in two separate categories. One, a confession made during the actual test, and a confession subsequent to the test. Mr. Davis confessed subsequent to the test. He actually gave a written confession after the test was completed. However, an important distinction...
Was he advised it was completed?
I'm sorry?
Was he advised that the test was completed?
He was advised that the test was completed after he indicated that he would give a written statement.
The test. Was he told he didn't pass it?
Yes.
Then what did he say?
He continued, he repeated his innocence. He was confronted with the results, and ultimately he indicated then he would give a test. At that point...
A confession.
Yes. At that point, the examiner indicates in a transcript at hearing he closed his laptop, informed Mr. Davis that the test was completed. So, and I think that's an excellent question, Justice, because... It's critical here that Only did Mr. Davis indicate that he was going to give an inculpatory statement. After he was convinced with the results to do so, and then he was told the test was completed.
But that's not part of the statement that would be admitted, right? That's just kind of sets the stage for him being taken to a different place, questioned by a different officer. He was told the examination was concluded, and then he, in a separate location with a different officer, then filled out a confession, right? I just want to be clear on the facts.
That is correct. However, as he was taken to a different location, well, first, ultimately, the officer who took the statement isn't the officer that conducted the exam.
Right.
However, that officer was informed of the results by the detective who did the exam. And even as Mr. Davis was led off to the other interview room to give his inculpatory statement, he was being told simultaneously by the officer that he still didn't believe him, that the results indicated otherwise, and he was doing the right thing by giving a statement.
So the officer that gave the test was in the room with the officer taking the statement in the separate location after the
officer
was concluded.
I'm sorry. No, the officer who gave the test was not in the same room during the actual taking of the statement.
Just escorted him.
I'm sorry.
Escorted him?
Yes.
To the new room, telling him he had lied and the test showed it, or
correct,
words to that effect. That's your position.
Correct. Yes.
Was that the officer that gave the test who escorted him to the second room, or a second officer?
It was a second officer.
Okay.
Was he given his Miranda warnings?
No. It was not.
Not at all?
Time?
Not to my knowledge.
Do you have a Miranda complaint? I mean, you're asserting that failing to give in Miranda warning when he's in custody, is he not?
Well, the finding was he was not in custody.
Oh, he's not in custody. Oh, that's good.
He came to the station voluntarily to give a statement. Well,
surprise, surprise, surprise.
Takes care of that problem.
Okay, so he's not in custody, came voluntarily so he could be interrogated without Miranda. Okay.
Exactly.
That's
exactly
good.
Yes.
Right.
Could you please explain precisely what happened before the test was administered?
Well, before the test was administered, he was brought into a room and explained how the test would work. My understanding is both Mr. Davis and the law enforcement officer who ultimately did the test worked out a series of questions that they would know were true or false, and two of the questions involved the sexual assault, and they agreed on what those questions would be. He then took the test, ultimately was told he failed the test, and then those results were used to garner a confession from him.
Was he a suspect, already accused of the sexual assault, and then voluntarily came in and said he'd take the test?
Yes. Well, I guess I have to put the word voluntarily sort of in quotations. He was a suspect.
Okay.
Accusations were made by the child. A report was made. He was contacted by the police. He concededly did offer to take the polygraph test. On the day that the test was to be given, he had made arrangements to meet with the detective at the police station, and he had car problems. So he called and left a message with the officer indicating he was on his way, he would be late. And he started to walk to the police station. And as he was walking, the police officer had already received the message and went to look for him, saw him walking down the street, pulled over, and invited to give him a ride. Unmarked police car. He agreed to get in and ride to the police station with the detective. And that's what led to the statement.
Did the defendant give a written consent to the test?
Honestly, Justice, I don't recall if there's a written consent or not. I know that he volunteered to take the test. but I'm unsure as to whether or not he signed a written consent. Now, the Court of Appeals certified this case and summarized the issue generally as, what is the reason that statements are automatically excluded when they're made during or closely related to a voice stress analysis examination? And sort of as a backdrop, I believe, to these cases is the premise that the results can be misused to unduly influence an individual to give an inculpatory statement. Or in other words, there's a real danger that the test can be misused as a psychologically coercive tool to extract a statement from an individual who obviously otherwise does not.
Counselor, but can't police just go into the room with him during questioning and say, we know you did it, we have all this information against you, the child has been very detailed, even if that's not the case, and we say if they can, the defendant confesses, it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. But the difference is, and I think that's an important question, because there are certain, what I believe to be truths that lead to that premise. The VSA, the voice stress analysis, is based upon and purported to be able to detect stress, an inaudible tremor in the voice box when a person is being untruthful, faced with a question that may have dire consequences. If we accept that as being true, every person who's being examined under these circumstances is under a certain amount of stress. They're obviously at the police station, but these tests aren't typically brought to an individual's living room and sat down in that circumstance.
We agree, I mean, at least you agree, that the results of the test cannot be admitted.
Correct.
Okay. So how do you get from that into not admitting anything else?
Well, if we accept that, if we can accept that the reason why it's excluded because of the undue or the great risk of undue coercion being used as a psychological tool during an examination, then it's not every instance where it can't be used. There has to be, as Greer, State v. Greer indicates, there has to be some sort of a nexus between the test and the confession. So if the results or if what an individual says during an examination are excluded, then what I'm trying to impress upon the court is that if it's said technically after the examination, but there's that nexus in evaluating those factors to the examination, then that too needs to be excluded, just as if, because then it's tied to the test. It's as if it were made during that examination.
The alleged sexual assaults here occurred on November 20th, is that right?
I would have to double-check on that, Justice. That sounds correct.
And the first interview with Mr. Davis was on November 21st, is that correct?
I think that is correct, yes.
And that was at the police station?
The initial interview occurred, well, the initial contact was with him at his home, but then there was a meeting at the police station.
And is it a fact that he twice offered to take polygraph test during that?
All
right. But no test was administered at that time?
No.
And it wasn't until December 17th that he was really asked or invited to come to the station?
Yes.
And he walked there?
Yes.
Except when he was picked up by a squad car.
Right.
All right. If he's offered to take the test, if he goes to the station voluntarily, how do you argue that he was overwhelmed by coercion?
Well, he wasn't coerced into taking the test. Clearly that's not the case. But the test was used to unduly influence him in giving an inculpatory statement. I think that's a significant difference. It's undeniable he offered to take the test. But And he exercised his own free will to do that. But the use of the test to extract from him an inculpatory statement was under such circumstances that that was not given of his own free will. When I initially spoke about the dangers of using the device as a psychological tool in extracting a confession, Mr. Davis didn't voluntarily agree to that. He agreed to take a test. He agreed to offer himself for a test. But it was the officers then who used that test to influence him after his repeated protestations that he was innocent.
Counsel, oftentimes officers use all sorts of information to extract a confession. Sometimes they even lie.
Right.
To extract a confession. Here they happen to use something truthful to extract a confession. Not necessarily truthful in that it's a reliable, admissible piece, but his failure of the test that he agreed to take. Now, if, on the other hand, they would have said, you know, we have this person in the other room who's been watching your body language, and that person indicates that you've been not telling the truth. And they didn't. They had no one in the other room, and it's just totally fabricated. And then he said, you know, you're right, I confess. That'd be admissible, right?
Yes. I think the difference is there's a vast public perception that lie detector tests in general are effective, that they work. We sort of live in a CSI world. These days, it doesn't seem like you can try a case without DNA evidence. Jurors want to hear that. They want to see that. And I think there is a real misperception in the world that these lie detector tests do work. So what you wind up, as opposed to the scenario that you lay out with the person watching the body language, you typically wind up in these interviews, these examinations, with vastly unequal footing. In this case, Mr. Davis has an eighth grade education. There's certainly the appearance that this individual is an expert. There's a laptop computer. There's a
that goes into a voluntariness analysis, though. As to whether he voluntarily confessed, that's a different analysis. And here the judge found that, A, he was there of his own volition, and B, the statement itself was voluntary. So an eighth grade education would go into a voluntariness
right.
analysis.
Well, yes. But I think if the issue or if the question is why shouldn't the test be able to be used to extract a confession, I think we have to look at what really happens during the examination and whether there is equal or unequal footing and whether there is a perception in the world that these tests are accurate. And when they're told, when someone is told and shown the graphs and shown the charts that, you know, we know you're lying and repeatedly over and over and over, assert the technology that they know that you're lying until someone ultimately, their will is worn down and give a confession.
Help me with this fact, because I'm not sure of this. They sat there with the graph results in front of him and pointed out where his lies were relevant or shown?
There is a graph as part of the record. The graph as part of the record. I think it's...
Was he confronted with that piece?
I believe he was shown that. Both detectives definitely talked about it. And if we look
talking
at,
about it and showing him the details of the graph, that
well, I'm not certain that even if he wasn't shown the graph himself, I'm not sure that that is an important distinction. He's certainly told there's the appearance of being an expert. There's an appearance of infallible technology, and he's being told that he failed. He's being told that they don't believe him, and he's being told that he's lying. And their belief is based upon the results of the examination. Whether showing them the graph or not, showing him the graph, quite frankly, wouldn't make any difference.
Okay.
Because as I look at the graph, I can't tell the difference. And if these were my responses to the questions and they were saying I lied here and told the truth here, I wouldn't be able to tell looking at the graph.
I'd like to just get back to some legal principles.
Yes.
What do you suggest is the law that is applicable to your client? So tell me what that law is, and then tell me how it applies to your client, because that's how one of us here is going to have to write that decision if it favors you or if it doesn't favor you. What's the law?
I do think the law needs a little clarification, but as the law applies to my client, I think Greer applies. Mr. Davis confessed after the examination,
right.
and Greer lays out a totality of the circumstances test to determine or to examine as to whether or not there is a nexus to the test, the confession as to the test. And it lays out certain factors. One is whether the test was over, whether the individual was told the test was over, whether the test was conducted in the same room that the interview was in, the length of time between the examination and the interview, and whether or not law enforcement used the results of the examination as a means to elicit the statement.
Okay. Now, I don't hear anything voluntary in that. I hear nexus. Is that the law of the land today?
I think the factor as to whether law enforcement used the results to garner a confession sort of takes into consideration the voluntariness. And so I do think that that is part of the
test. Okay, but that's used as a nexus. If they said, here, you lied, you better tell us. We've got proof. Look at this tangible paper with all this graph on it. That looks like there's a nexus between the polygraph and the confession. If they don't say that, different offices in different room, then, and they didn't use the result, that's one factor showing no nexus, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, as I understand it, the state would want us to go to a voluntary basis. Just say, look, you don't introduce the polygraph, but you can introduce comments during the polygraph, before the polygraph, after the polygraph, as long as they are voluntary. And we've got lots of law that talks about voluntary, knowing and intelligent voluntary, right?
Yes.
Not coerced.
Yes.
All right. Do you think this court, are you supporting an adoption of that law?
No.
No, you want to stay with what we got
yes.
now, nexus.
Yes.
And you think that under those five tests, your client, there was no nexus, that there was a nexus.
Yes.
Because it was over. He told that it was over. It was a different room, though.
It was a different room. However, he had been brought back and forth three or four times, leaving him certainly with the impression, one would believe, that if he was in the interview room and the interview didn't go very well, he certainly could be brought back to the testing room where more testing could be done.
Okay, so you think he saw a nexus. Is that the test, whether he sees a nexus or whether us looking at it objectively, we see a nexus, or a reasonable person would see a nexus?
I think it has to be where the court sees a nexus.
And that would be a reasonable person would see
yes.
a nexus.
Yes.
All right. What about the length of time?
I think that's an important factor.
And it was short here.
It's almost seamless in this case.
Okay.
The officers testified that he told him the test, after he agreed to give a statement, incriminate himself, he told him that the test was over, he closed his laptop. He was then taken to the other room.
Okay.
So it's virtually seamless.
I'm going to raise a different issue with you. Okay? And I'm going to raise this with the state. Section 942.06, are you familiar with that?
Not off the top of my head. I'm not one with the numbers. If
I'll read it to you. Except as provided in 2M, which I'll read to you too, no person may require or administer a polygraph, voice stress analysis, psychological stress evaluator, or other similar tests purporting to test honesty without the prior written and informed consent of the subject. It was last amended in 2001. This all happened after 2001, right?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And then sub 2 says No person may disclose that another person has taken one of these tests except to the person tested. And then 2M, I originally thought 94206 only related to Chapter 111, which dealt with employment relations. And that 94206, which is a criminal statute, really referred only to employment relations. And that's the way it was when it was adopted. Mm-hmm. It only referred to employment relations. But then I read 2M, which says that subsection 1, which prohibits these tests without consent, written consent, sub 1 doesn't apply to 1, an employee or agent of the Department of Corrections who conducts a lie detector test of a sex offender. So we're a little out of employment now.
Mm-hmm.
And second exception, which means that a lie detector can be given, is by an employee or agent of the Department of Health and Family Services who conducts a lie detector under 51375. I don't know what that is, but we're out of employment.
Right.
We are now into the criminal law, at least as to the Department of Corrections. And then 2Q also says, deals with the Department of Correction and a sex offender, et cetera. So we have a statute that, one, makes it a crime for anyone who violates this. And that's why you were asked the question of whether there was prior written consent.
And in my reading of the statute, I think it applies to results of the test.
No person may require or administer a polygraph without prior consent.
But as far as the privilege goes, I think it applies to the results.
You are right, because 2 says no person may disclose the results. And sub 3 says whoever violates the section, which could be administering or disclosing the results. Now, nothing in this statute, 942062, says you suppress. This is nothing is there about suppress. The words are no person may disclose. Now, there was a similar statute several years ago on wiretaps. It's a federal statute. And in the Nardone case, the court interpreted no person may disclose to mean that federal law enforcement officer couldn't testify as to that in court. And they interpreted comparable words to sub 2 to cover a law enforcement officer, although, like the other, it was broader than law enforcement. Here we don't have to worry about that because 2M seems to open up the door.
Right.
So what do you say about all that?
Well, I'm not familiar with the federal case, but I know when I did look at that statute, and my feeling at the time in looking at it was that it had limited application here because it did apply to results and not the statement that might be given as a result of the test as opposed to the results themselves.
Right. You can't disclose the result of the test. So that doesn't cover this case, in your opinion.
I don't think
because so. If you went to court, they're not interested in telling you the results. They want to only give the confession. But in giving the confession, aren't they going, either the state or the defendant, aren't they going to have to say how they got that confession?
Yes.
And will they have to reveal the results or at least somehow?
Well, I think at that point the results, whether they're said or not, are revealed to the jury. The state would propose a test whereby it's a voluntariness issue and defense would have the opportunity to explain to the jury how the statement was given and address issues of voluntariness concerning the use of the test. As a trial attorney, that's a poor solution, because now the jury's hearing it not just once in the state's case, but they're going to hear it again in my case, and they're going to hear it again in closings, that there was a lie detector test, and obviously this gentleman failed the test.
Did that happen here? Because the way I understood the judge's ruling and the way that I've seen this handled is where you have the officer testify that Mr. Davis was in the police station on that day, and on that day he gave an interview and the following statement. You don't bring up the test, and then defense counsel often wants to bring up the test, but not the prosecution. And the law seems to be pretty clear. You don't bring it up because that just opens the can of worms.
That is how that happened in this case. But I think the state's proposing what I just went through, and I see that as a poor solution. I see that as more devastating to...
Who has the burden of proof on the confession that it's admissible?
Well, the state does.
State does. So the state has to show it's voluntary, knowing, intelligent.
Yes.
Made. So just introducing the confession would not satisfy their burden, would it?
Well, to be admissible in the first instance, the voluntariness issue is dealt with by the court, and then if it's voluntary, then it's admissible. Then the state can introduce it, right?
Right. I would, yeah, if there's a claim that it's not voluntary, then Miranda, Goodchild type hearing would be held to determine the voluntariness, knowing, intelligent waiver sort of thing.
Right. And does the jury get a shot at it too?
I'm sorry?
Does the jury get a chance to determine whether it's voluntary also?
Ultimately, yes, absolutely.
Yes. So it's not a final decision by the judge in the Goodchild.
Ultimately, in any criminal case on any, well, on certainly on any issue of guilt or innocence, it's the jury that decides, obviously.
Well, and not suppression. The judge suppresses, it's gone.
Right, unless there's a suppression. Correct.
Okay.
I know I'm out of time. Well, I'll deal with it in rebuttal.
You have several moments in rebuttal, counsel. Ms. Wellman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good morning. Thank you. I am Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman representing the plaintiff respondent in this case. We're here today on certification from the Court of Appeals, and we're asking this court to overrule State v. Schleiss, which is 86 was second, which is the case that adopted the test or the ruling that a statement, a defendant's statement or confession that is made during a polygraph, and we believe the same test applies to voice stress analysis, during a polygraph or voice stress analysis, or made in a post-test interview that is not distinct in time and circumstances, time and content, from the polygraph is excluded. We believe, as the Court of Appeals indicated in certification, that there's no justification or rationale in Schleiss for that rule, and that rather the admissibility of a statement of a defendant, whether it's made before, during, or after a polygraph, should simply be tested by the ordinary constitutional standards applicable to all other statements and confessions of defendants, which is whether it's voluntary, and if applicable, whether it was properly Mirandized, which is not applicable here because he was not in custody and he came to the station voluntarily. We believe that the voluntariness test is perfectly adequate to deal with any concerns about coercion that might occur in a particular case. Certainly, we're not saying that no individual defendant could ever be improperly coerced by a person who gives a polygraph examination or a police officer who interviews the defendant afterwards. Obviously, any particular questioning of a defendant, testing of a defendant, interrogation, the police or the examiner could use coercive tactics, and then we would balance the defendant's personal characteristics against that coercion and improper police conduct, if there were any, and determine whether the coercive aspects overbore the defendant's will such that under due process his statement cannot come in.
But Ms. Wellman, do we have to overrule Schleiss in order to allow the admissibility of this statement to stand?
No, you don't have to. We also believe that even under the Schlice rule, which was followed in Greer and Johnson, that this statement is admissible. But the Court of Appeals is asking this court to reexamine Schlice, at the very least, to provide an articulated rationale so that the courts know how to figure the factors in and what to do with the factors, because they don't seem to have anything to do with why you would keep the statement out, or to just, you know, reexamine it and come to a different conclusion.
Why do you think this is admissible under Greer and under Schlice?
Under Greer and Schlice, it clearly was after the voice test analysis, because he had been unhooked from the instrument, which in this case is just a microphone hooked to a computer. It's not the regular polygraph stuff. He was told that it was over. The person who gave the polygraph was different. That detective was different than the detective who ultimately took the written statement. There was a short time between the two, but Greer teaches us that that is not the most important factor. It was two different officers. Physically, he gave the statement in a different room than the room in which he had taken the polygraph. He had been told at the end of the voice stress analysis that the chart indicated that he was being deceptive as to two questions, but that was not used during the actual statement. In other words, the officer who took the statement told him, "I don't believe you," but he didn't refer to the voice stress analysis. And that detective, who was Detective Swanson, in fact testified that he didn't believe him from day one. He interviewed him at his home after the child first revealed the incident back in November. And in light of the child's detailed description, he didn't believe him at all. So he wasn't badgering him with the charts and the, you know, you're lying, look at this line, look at this chart, look at this wiggle, whatever they use on those graphs. He wasn't doing that at all during the interrogation. In fact, the voice stress test was never mentioned. So we think all of those factors under Greer, this statement is certainly admissible. But we also think, pursuant to the certification, that this court ought to abandon Schlice and adopt the rule that all the other jurisdictions have, which is that when a statement is made before, during, or following a polygraph or voice stress, and the defendant claims his statement's involuntary, then we simply use the ordinary, well-developed voluntariness test, which, of course, is as stated in Wisconsin, and I think, do you pronounce it Hops or Hopes? H-O-P-P-E-S and Clappis. Hoppy?
May I ask here?
Sure.
What was the police officer entitled to administer the test to this defendant?
Before this morning, I would have said most certainly, because the record shows, and the suppression hearing is 98, and he said that he was asked, "Did you get his consent, or you asked for his consent?" And he said yes, at page 51 of record 98. There's nothing in the record to indicate whether that was or was not a written consent. I did not see a written consent in the record. It's possible, I suppose, that it's in circuit court and just didn't get sent up, but no one asked that question, so I do not know if it was simply an oral or a written consent. Now, under the statute that Justice Abramson was reading a moment ago, it sounds like it is prohibited to give a polygraph or reveal the results unless you have written consent. Now, that statute, I take it, imposes a penalty for violation, so it's a
Class B misdemeanor.
Okay, so it's a standalone criminal statute, which I suppose could mean that there was a misdemeanor violation here if there was no statement or consent in writing, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the statement should be suppressed. There's nothing in that statute, I gather, although I have to admit I was not aware of it and did not read it before now.
It comes under subsection 2.
Okay.
No person may disclose the result. But we're not talking about the result here, but you're talking to something that is attained as a result of that.
Right, right. So it seems to me the face of that statute would not apply to the statement or confession of the defendant.
You might want to look at the Nardone cases, which were wiretap federal cases.
Okay.
Where I think the U.S. Supreme Court first said under no person may divulge, it was a privilege. No person may divulge what was revealed in the wiretap. And they said that applied to federal agents.
Okay, but again,
it applied to evidence in court.
Right, but if the statement, the confession here was after the exam, as we say it was, then that seems that still wouldn't apply either.
Well, then the second case said that evidence that they got as a result of listening in, so that it was the second layer, that too was not admissible because it undercut the whole concept of not allowing illegal interceptions and not allowing divulging. So,
yeah, I just have to look at those cases. I mean,
yeah,
obviously,
you will.
I'd be happy to rebrief. I'm sure we both would. If you want us to look
but
into that.
But that's not something that you're not prosecuting any police officers for not getting prior written consent.
No. And I will mention in the record at the suppression hearing when both detectives testified, the trial court did bring it up himself, and he said, wait a minute, isn't there a privilege here or a statute that doesn't allow this to be divulged without consent? Now, he didn't give a statute number, so I don't know if he was thinking of the statute that the Court of Appeals cited, which is separate from the one you're talking about, 942. In any event, he did then take an on-the-record colloquy with the defendant personally, and he waived the right to bar that from being revealed, both the statement and the results. But it was not in writing. And whether we can say that if this is an issue in this case, an oral waiver on the record in a court of law is sufficient, even though it's technically not written, I guess that's a question that
well, it seems to me the
too.
State wants to soar way beyond this case and develop new law. And I don't see how you do that by kind of virtually disregarding 905.065. I mean, the only reference to it is in a footnote of the brief. But, I mean, it is a privilege here. It is a privilege, and the only way you get around that privilege is if there is a signed written agreement from the defendant. That isn't here.
Well, I have two responses to that. One is that the defendant is not arguing that his statement should not be admissible because it was privileged.
I understand that, but you want a whole sweeping change of the law.
We want a whole sweeping change of the law in terms of the Schlice rule that draws this distinction between statements made during polygraphs or closely connected to polygraphs. And we think that rule should be thrown out and all statements should be tested under the voluntariness test rather than the Schlice test. I have to say that my impression from reading other case law in Wisconsin, such as Schlice itself, and I believe Greer specifically mentioned, there usually, with a polygraph at least, there is a written consent form. And that seems to be pretty standard. Now, whether that just didn't happen in this case, whether it didn't happen because it was a voice stress and nobody thought about it, or whether there, in fact, is a written consent form, but it's just not in the record that came up here, I don't know. But in terms of, you know, making a broad sweeping change, I think that in most cases in Wisconsin, it's not a problem. If we abandon the Schlice rule, it won't create privilege problems and problems with 942, because in most cases, I believe the officers get a signed consent. And if they don't, we certainly will be telling them henceforth that they need to be aware of these statutes.
Ms. Wellman, I understand the state's argument with respect to whether this court should change the rule regarding voluntariness of statements made post polygraph or voice stress test. I'm not sure I understand the rationale of the state's argument for arguing that the rule should change regarding statements made during the test. And the reason I ask the question is because it seems to me that the whole point and the whole purpose of the test is to get the individual to answer the questions, to speak truthfully, to go through as part of the scientific basis for the test. There's a stress test that's being given. And so you're asking questions during the test to determine whether or not the individual is telling the truth or not. You can't do that unless the person is encouraged to speak. And so it seems to me that if you're going to now separate out things that are said during the administration of that test, it can run contrary to the very science that is used to take the test in the first instance. And if the point is to encourage an individual to speak, but then you're going to say, but now we can use anything that's said during the test as evidence, then that would send the message to encourage the individual not to take the test in the first instance. And so that there seems to be a conflict, at least with respect to the statements that the state wants to get at that would be made during the test. I understand what your argument post-test, but it concerns me how this would be utilized for statements made during the test.
And what we mean by statement made during the test, for example, my understanding is in the polygraph and the voice test, they give like a limited number of questions and answers. And the question would be, did you put your penis in your six-year-old daughter's mouth? And if he says no, and the test shows that that's a lie, or he's being deceptive. We're not saying that that answer can come in, and perhaps we should have been more clear about this. We're talking about a statement that he makes that's not a direct answer, because the direct answer would be the result of the polygraph. So, for example, if during the test he's being asked a question, and between two questions, he answers a question no, and then the next question comes, and he's sitting there thinking, and suddenly he says, I can't bear this any longer. You're going to find out anyway. I feel so guilty about this. I want to tell you everything. And he tells him everything, and it's a full confession. The fact that it happened while he was still connected to the machine or with the microphone on, if it's voluntary, shouldn't keep it out. So when we say statements made, we mean a confession that is that kind of confession. I was not anticipating that the state, under the guise of our new rule, would be able to put in the questions and answers to the actual test. Does that clarify it for you? Okay.
Do you then suggest that under the fact scenario that you just pointed out just now, that his saying, I want to confess, is tantamount to a waiver of the privilege under 905.065? 905.065 sub 2 says there's a privilege to prevent another from disclosing any oral or written communication during or any results. And the hypothetical you just gave was an oral communication during. Of course, accepted the question answer, but this would have been, in your hypothetical, an oral communication during. So what do you do with the privilege that's given under the statute to preclude the dissemination of that information?
I think that, under my hypothetical, that would be a separate issue that we would have to deal with, a separate problem. Now, if in my hypothetical, we also had the normal written consent and agreement form that they talk about in sub 4, then it wouldn't be a problem because there's no privilege if you have that form. If you don't have that form and you had a blurted out voluntary confession in the middle of a test and the defendant was raising the privilege as a grounds for keeping it out of evidence, then I think, you know, in theory we would have a problem with that case. I think it's a separate issue from the Schleiss and voluntariness issue and what we mean by saying a confession, regardless of when it is made, we shouldn't be drawing these artificial lines that are drawn in Schleiss, and we should use a voluntariness test.
In your response to Justice Butler, you posed a question that I won't repeat, but so, if the answer was no, obviously, we would not use that. Suppose the answer was yes. I thought I understood you to say that that couldn't be used either.
I think the actual question and answer that are part of the test, we could not bring that in, because I think under Dean, that would be the results of the examination, because the results are both the answers and what the chart or whatever shows about the deceptiveness, is my understanding. Now, if he then went on, separate from that, and gave a full confession, then I think that could come in. Although I have to say, now that I think of it, I'm not aware of any case that we have or that I've seen where the defendant has said yes in answering a question, and then that's an actual question of the polygraph or voice stress test, and then there's a question whether that question and that answer can come in. I haven't seen that.
Isn't what you're suggesting just a repackaging of the same problem that you're trying to prevent? You suggest that we should adopt voluntariness, that this nexus, totality of the circumstances, or nexus, the Schleiss, the Johnson, Greer, doesn't work. You want something brighter, something cleaner. But boy, I can anticipate the arguments of, that was really an answer. No, he had stopped answering. He had paused. He looked the other direction, and then he continued. And then we get into the whole arguments of is there attenuation from the answer? Just like we have now under the Greer test, is it sufficiently attenuated? It seems to me when you start picking and choosing, when did he stop answering that question? It's a whole new area of litigation.
I guess my best answer to that is, if the state brings in the defendant's statement, now in this case it was a little easier because it was clearly after the test, but even if it had been separate but during the test, if he had suddenly opened up during the test and volunteered a lot of information, as long as in this case, the state brought his confession in very cleanly. There was no mention of the polygraph. The state just asked the officers, did you talk to Mr. Davis on X date at the police station? Yes. Were you aware he had previously, denied the offense? Yes. Did he agree to talk to you? Whatever those questions were. And what did he tell you that day? And he read the written confession into the record. The detective did. There was no mention that it was in any context, any way related to a polygraph. And I think that can be done very cleanly, as the state did here. I think part of the reason for Schleiss and the concern was that in Schleiss, the polygraph examiner who worked for the crime lab was the one who also did the post-test interrogator interview. And he's the one who testified. And it was, although he never directly said he gave the defendant a polygraph and the defendant failed, it was pretty clear, I think, to a jury that the polygraph was involved, because when he testified, he said, I'm Robert Anderson, I work at the state crime lab, I'm a polygraph examiner. Then he talked about talking to the defendant, and he talked about showing the defendant the charts, and he referred to the test. And in Schleiss, that was the defendant's real argument, was, look, it was so intertwined that the jury couldn't help but know there was a polygraph here. And I think that did trouble the court, and legitimately so. But we don't have that here, and we don't have to have it.
Well, how does the defendant raise the issue of voluntariness? State puts on a very clean case, as you have just said, and defendant says, this is not, and we're going to use your voluntary test. Trial court will. What does the defendant do on cross-examination of the police officer?
You mean at trial?
Pardon me?
You mean at trial, not at the suppression hearing, right?
Yeah.
Okay. At trial, if the defendant wants to, I think he has a constitutional right to bring in the circumstances that it was during a polygraph exam. They told me I lied. I only confessed because I lied. I felt pressured.
He's waived his privilege.
Right. He's waived the privilege, and he's waived the right to keep those references out.
Well.
Which is.
But then he has no defense of voluntariness.
Well, no, he has a defense of, he's If the state, if he challenges his confession prior to trial on grounds of what I'll say traditional voluntariness, where we balance improper police conduct against personal characteristics, and it still comes in and the court holds it can come in, and that's appropriate, he can still try to litigate to the jury, you shouldn't believe it because
it wasn't. But he can't tell the jury. He can't, because if he questions the witness, your witness, and says, tell me the circumstances, and the circumstances are the ones in this case, namely, came in, volunteered to take a polygraph, took the polygraph, was told that he lied, went into the next room, and then confessed. But that wasn't voluntary, according to the defendant. He's waived any of the privileges he has. That's your position.
Right, right.
So your position is that he has to give up any reference to the polygraph in order to prove to counter voluntariness, because your job is to prove voluntariness, right?
Our job is to prove credibility.
But your job is to show that this was a voluntary confession.
Right.
It's your burden, the state's burden. So it seems to me, as I played it out in my mind, Ms. Wellman, that the concept of voluntariness is so intertwined with the facts that he took a polygraph that you have placed the defendant in an impossible situation. You do not enable him to exercise a privilege that he has under the state statute, because it's going to come in, and then you're going to yell waiver, which I think is valid. So it, to me, adopting your test, which raises, as Justice Bradley says, its own set of problems of proof, adopting that test creates confusion and creates, it's totally intertwined with the polygraph, which itself, its results are outlawed for the reason that it's not reliable as a matter of law.
Well, this court didn't say it's not reliable as a matter of law and dinginess.
But
it was insufficiently reliable in light of all the risks of prejudice.
Right.
And
okay.
So right. you didn't totally say it was unreliable. Let me just respond, though.
Came awfully close. I haven't seen any case that's let it in.
Not in Wisconsin.
Not in
Wisconsin.
You ought to wait until they refine the test, Ms. Wellman. It's on their way.
Well, I think the privilege issue is separate, and I have to admit, because it wasn't briefed and I wasn't aware of the other statute.
And the state, the Court of Appeals, didn't the Court of Appeals say that it wasn't raised here?
They raised that issue, and then when it wasn't briefed in this court, I assumed it wasn't an issue in this case, and that was the defendant's choice. However, even the privilege as it's written in the statute cited in the certification, which is, I don't have the number in front of me, that only applies to statements made during the polygraph or the lie detector test. So it still wouldn't apply in our case where there's a post-test interview.
Well, isn't that the question? What does during mean?
Well, but in this case, it seems to me that when it's over, he's been told it's over.
Let me go through the facts. That makes me, because I'm not all that clear on the facts. And as I understand it, the test was administered in the family room.
Right.
And when he began to show some deception, he was taken to the interview room. And then the test administrator, the one that gave it in the family room, discussed the deception with the interviewing officer. Then the defendant was brought back to the family room. Testing equipment was still there. He was informed of his deception in front of the interviewing officer, and he began to cry. And at that point, the test administrator, so you have both of them in the family room, the test administrator and the interviewing officer. And at that point, the test administrator closed his computer, and then the interviewer took the defendant back into the interview room and he confessed. Are those the facts?
Well, there's an additional fact that the test giver said, "I'm finished," and closed up his... So, I mean, he clearly was telling the
defendant. In the family room, you have the interviewer and the test giver, and then he closed up his... He closed up his computer, said he's finished, and then the interviewer took him into the... Isn't that when the defendant then said something about, "I'm ready to talk"?
Well, he said he was willing to talk to Detective Swanson, who was the one who took the ultimate statement. Yeah. He didn't say, "I'm going to give a confession."
No,
or
but he said, "Okay, so my statement of facts are correct, that first he was in the family room. Little deception was thought about. Then they take him to the interview room. The administrator of the test talks to the interviewing officer. Then they take him back into the family room. There's more stuff that goes on. Ultimately, the administrator closes his computer and says, "We're finished." The guy starts crying, I think maybe before he closes his computer, and that is the defendant. And then the interviewer takes him back into the interviewing room. How long was it between this close of the computer and the beginning of the confession then?
I think the officer testified it was about 5 minutes. I'm just checking to make sure that I agree with what you
said. That's why it seemed to me there were various facts going on during question and answer here, and that's my understanding that both the interviewer and the administrator were in the room. We're back in the family room when this close of computer went on and the defendant started crying.
Right. We say at record 9826, there was about a five-minute period between the closing of the laptop and the interview. Let me just say, and I realize we don't have too much more time here, but in our brief, we do discuss the issue of the dilemma that it puts the defendant in. If he wants to defend on the grounds that tell the jury, "You shouldn't believe my confession. It was a crime. You know, none of it was true because I only said it because they told me I lied." Now, whether a jury would find that necessarily makes it not true, that would be up to the jury. But, you know, we can deal with that with the limiting instructions that we suggest in our brief. And that is not unique. That putting the defendant to that difficult choice is not unique to polygraphs. It comes up, for example, if the police tell the defendant, "Look, your co-defendant over here already talked to us. He told us everything. He said you were the guy with the gun. You were the guy who shot the clerk, blah, blah, blah." The state is not going to be able to put that part in unless the co-defendant testifies at trial. Let's assume he doesn't testify. The defendant has to bring it in if he wants to say, "Look, my confession wasn't true. I only said it because they said Joe had already nailed me." So it's not unique to polygraphs, so I don't think we should get hung up on that. The privilege might be unique to polygraphs, but...
Or wiretaps. Well, except that the defendant, the state can get testimony that what the state said to get the confession was that the co-defendant confessed or pointed the finger. It's not presented for the truth of the allegation, but the truth of the statement. It's presented that the statement was made. That the officer made the statement, not that the officer was telling the truth. So I don't see any problem. It's quite different than the privilege issue. It's not a hearsay problem.
All right, I see what you're saying. And I don't know if it's possible. I think a court can consider it too highly prejudicial
sure.
to let in any way. But
and that's the issue with the polygraph in your statement here, that it was there was too highly prejudicial.
Right. But as long as the state doesn't bring in the polygraph evidence, we believe that limiting instructions are sufficient if the defendant chooses to bring it in.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Grahamstrup.
I did want to touch briefly on one of the issues, one of the factors that Greer talks about, and that is whether the individual was told that the test was over at the time that he gave his statement. Technically, in this case, the test was over And Mr. Davis was told the test was over before he gave his statement. However, what I don't want to be lost on this court is the fact that at the time he was told the test was over, he had already been convinced to give a statement. That is an important fact.
Counselor, let me ask you, because I'm not sure how important that fact is. I understand that this case is up here because the state is asking, on the one hand, to extend the rule, and on the other hand, you're saying, hey, none of this stuff should. But why isn't this case simply covered under our traditional case law by McAdoo versus State, which is a situation where the defendant went to the station voluntarily, was not in custody at the time he gave the statement, was hooked up to a polygraph with Examiner Anderson. At one point, at 2:25, he indicates that he wants to discontinue the test. The machine was taken off of him, turned off. He's informed the test was over. They don't even leave the room, and the examiner himself continues the conversation with the defendant. And this court held that, given the fact that there was a specific determination that from the record that the test was over, the defendant was informed the test was over, and he was freely conversing with the examiner, that was held to be admissible. Why do we have to go down either path that the parties are asking us to go down? Isn't this controlled by McAdoo?
Well, I think the distinction is that it's the use of the test. And I think the Greer totality of the circumstances test takes that into consideration in determining, the status of the test. Is it ongoing? Is it not ongoing? And does the individual know that? And then it does also take into consideration certain areas of voluntariness, whether or not the test was in fact used to elicit the statement, which clearly I think in this case it was. And it also takes into consideration the other factors that go into that, such as the unequal footing, the fact that Mr. Davis has an eighth grade education, and the enormous stress that he was under. It's undisputed. The record reflects that when all was said and done that day, he was under such stress that these officers drove him to the crisis center. He was suicidal. That's the circumstance that he is giving his inculpatory statement. And clearly, it was a result of the detective's use of that information, the results of the test, and the situation that it was administered. The distinction that Greer doesn't make it real clear that it's significant, that it's important, that the timing is that the defendant was told the test was over. The only difference between Mr. Davis and another individual who might not be told the test is over while he's giving his statement is the fact that the detectives already had what they wanted from him. That was he had agreed to give them a confession. Only at that point was he told then the test was over. The detective closed his laptop, and they immediately moved him to a different room to give a statement. And in fact, as he's being moved to the other room to give a statement, he again is being told simultaneously that we don't believe you, we know you're lying, you're doing the right thing by giving us a statement. So it continued on even into. The fact that the charts and graphs and results weren't used during the actual taking of the statement is because it wasn't needed. They had already done that and had already used that to get him to confess. They didn't have to do that during the statement.
Counsel, can I just follow up on something I asked you about earlier? Detective Swanson took the statement, right?
Yes.
And when I'm looking at Detective Swanson's testimony, he was, it says, and after Detective Brunning closed the laptop and left, when you initially talked to Keith Davis in that family room, and then when you continued later, you talked to him in that interview, did you ever talk to him about the boy stress test at all? Answer, never during those times, no. Did you even mention the boy stress test to him? No, I did not.
Right.
So where is the test being used to extract the confession? Just trying to sort out that fact.
It's because Detective Swanson didn't have to use it. It was used in the interview room, it was used in the testing room to get him to agree to give a statement.
I see. Okay, but not in getting the statement.
Right.
I misunderstood you.
Right. And what I'm asserting is that the only reason it probably wasn't used during the interview itself was because it wasn't needed. They had already convinced him with results, graphs, questioning, and their statements to give a statement. I see my time is up. Thank you very much for your consideration.
But thank you, Mr. Gramstrup, and thank you, Ms. Wellman, for your arguments in polygraph case that we haven't had for a long time in a different kind of posture. That concludes our hearing on 06 AP 1954 CR State versus Davis. The court will take a brief recess so that other students who wish to enter the courtroom may do so. We are in recess.